Let yourself become aware of your body and just suggest to it to relax, to deeply relax, as though you're allowing all of the muscles to release their tension or any stress or any clinging to the bones. Just allowing them to relax deeply into space so that the body the line between the body and space becomes unnoticeable. And let yourself enjoy the sensations of relaxation. Kind of the natural pleasure. Relaxation is pleasure for the body. And so enjoy the sensation of the body. Let go of any stress or tension, anything that it might be holding. And also use your breath to release any stress and to fill the body with some positive energy. Now let your mind also relax into space. Let it be in a positive presence, a grateful presence. Let yourself enjoy all of the grace that you have to have a physical body and to have a mind. To have sense organs, to have an intellect. Realize how hard your mind works for you, actually. See if you can just let the mind be as it is, whatever it's working through, whatever it's feeling or thinking. See if you can simply objectify it and appreciate your mind for whatever it may be going through or feeling or being at this moment. budding clinging, just simply let the mind and the body relax. Let them be as they are. And without trying to change them or control them, just simply allowing them to be. Shift your focus a bit to just your own presence. You don't need to control the body or the mind to shift the focus. Whatever thoughts or sensations, sounds, perceptions that are there, none of them disturb your own presence. Let your presence fill your mind and body. And let your mind and body relax into your presence. Presence totally embraces the body and your mind, your perceptions, and your body and your mind and your perceptions relax into your presence. Notice the silent well-being that you are. Let the mind relax into that. Well-being. Solid, stable, silent self. As the mind gets to know, to recognize the stability of yourself, it gains strength because of that security. The secure, stable self. Always whole, complete. Non-judgmental, present to whatever experiences are there. Accepting, non-rejecting. the mind recognize me. Let the mind recognize me, the one who is always here. Let the mind relax into me. Quiet, stable presence. That you are. You are the stable home, the stable self. The source of well-being for the mind. The source of ananda for the mind. The source of love . There is no distance. between the mind and the wholeness that it seeks. Mind simply needs to relax. And recognize myself as the wholeness that it seeks. Om Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamani Santadami Bhagavad Gita Bhavad Tveshini. Numbers chapter 2, verse 45. Trigunya Vishaya Vedaha. Trigunya Vishaya Vedaha. Nistrigunyo Pavarjuna. Nistrigunyo pavarjana nirdvandvo nityasattvastaha nirdvandvo nityasattvastaha niryogakshema atmavan niryogakshema atmavan. Compound here. Tri gunya vishayaha. Trigunya Vishayaha Vedaha Nistrigunyaha Bhava Arjuna Nirdvandvaha Nitya Satvastaha Niryoga Kshemaha Atmavan. We're still in the section where Krishna is praising Karma Yoga and the Mumukshu, the one who has recognized the problem. So he's going to be saying a lot of things. He's setting Arjuna up without yet explaining what these things are. Right? So let's look at this. He says, Trigunya Vishayaha Vedaha. The Vedas, Vedaha, nominative plural, Trigunya Vishayaha, whose subject matter, Vishaya, are the three gunas, Trigunya, Tri is three, Trigunya Vishayaha Vedaha. The Vedas have for their subject matter the three gunas, Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, means samsara. I'll unfold that in a minute. Let's just get the Sanskrit first. Okay. Trigunya Vishayaha Vedaha. The four Vedas, the Vedas, have for their vishaya, their content, their subject matter, trigunya, the three gunas. Nistrigunyaha bhava Arjuna. Hey Arjuna, may you be one who is free of these three gunas. Nis means without. Nistrigunyaha. May you be one who is nistrigunyaha, free of these three gunas. Nirdvandvaha. May you be free of the opposites. Dvandvas are the opposites, the pairs of opposites. Nir means without. May you be free of those. Nirdvandvaha, one who is free. Nirdvandvaha. May you be nitya sattvastaha, one who's always abiding in sattva, the sattva guna. Okay? Nitya, always. Sattva, the sattva guna. Staha. May you always remain in the sattva guna. We'll see what these mean in a minute. Nitya sattvastaha. All of these noms are singular here. Hey Arjuna, may you be all of these things. May you be nir yoga kshema, one who is free of yoga and kshema. We'll see yoga means a person who has yoga kshema. Yoga means the person who is worried about what they're going to get. I need to get this, I need to attain that, I need to attain this for my happiness, for my well-being. The kshema is, I need to maintain this. Now that I've got it, I've got to hang on to it. I need to protect it. So here he says, nir yoga kshema, be one who is free of this yoga kshema. And the last one is atmavan, that vat affix in the nominative singular is van, one who has control of oneself, means body, mind, sense organs. Here just atma means oneself. Atmavan, one who has control of oneself. Whether it be your sense organs or your mind or your physical body, where you have the body, you have the mind, you have the sense organs, not that they have you. That's the idea. So you have control over this. It's your body, your mind, your sense organs, which you use as instruments rather than they running off with you like wild horses, you know, as the Katha Upanishad and Gita is also used. Okay, so now that's the verse. All nominatives, may you be this, may you be this, may you be this, may you be this. For the Vedas themselves, he says, the Vedas are trigunya vishayaha, means the subject matter of the Vedas, means the Karmakanda really, the subject matter of the Vedas, are the sattva, rajas, and tamas, means the whole creation. And if we think of Maya, the Maya Upadi, Maya itself is sattva, rajas, and tamas. Those are the components of Maya, right? And so the Maya projects as sattva, rajas, and tamas. And we have the sattva aspect, the rajas aspect, the tamas aspect that goes through this whole panchikarana. So in a sense, this whole creation is sattva, rajas, and tamas. That's what it is. The Vedas deal with this creation, like the whole karmakanda. And it has to do, the whole karmakanda, all of the rituals have to do with how to be in this creation. How to be in samsara. How to be in samsara means how to get as much pleasure from it as possible and how to avoid as much pain, to avoid pain. So it's all sukha-dukha. How to negotiate in this creation. How to negotiate sukha-dukha. How to be happy here. So that's what all, in these previous verses, this is all that Krishna was talking about, where he says, he ended, before we go into this verse, the verse says, Boga Aishwarya Prasaktanam. For those people whose attachment is to pleasure and power, Boga is pleasure, and Aishwarya means power. So for those who, that's where your drive is, for those people, that's where their attachment is, those people's mind has been robbed, has been actually taken away by the flowery words of the Vedas. If you do this, you'll get that. If you do this, you can get to Swargaloka. If you do these rituals, you can attain this. You can attain these pleasures. You can attain these lokas, and you can attain these states of, not just states of experience, but what we call sthanas. You can actually become a devata, right? Or you can be born into a rich family. You can become a king. You know? Or you can have overlordship over large areas and large areas of the universe, like you could be an Indra. Yeah. So all of this is what the Vedas deal with. How can you have the most? How can you gain the most happiness? In fact, and we'll be dealing with this in a minute. In the Taittiriya Upanishad, they go through all of the different things that that a jiva can attain. And we'll start out with, in this loka, for the ananda that you can, what's the most ananda that you can get in this loka here, in this bhuloka? You could be, they're speaking in the masculine, you could be, you know, a king who has a healthy body and a happy family, very good looking, and overlordship over all of the other kingdoms. Because otherwise you would be threatened. So you have to have overlordship of all of the other kingdoms. So you could have that and a long life, full of health, healthy children, everything perfect. But you could have that in this loka. That's the maximum ananda that you could achieve here. But you know, in the one loka up, there's so much more ananda in the amount of happiness that they can, the Gandharvas, for instance, that with all of their singing and the joy and the pleasures that they can have. And they have a more subtle body also. And so they get to have more consistent happiness that puts this loka to shame. But then above that, there's another loka. And the pleasures that they can have in that loka, the joys and the accomplishments and the power, the pleasures, put that loka to shame. And then, of course, there's Swarga loka, the highest loka. There is nothing better than that. The Swarga loka, the highest loka, puts all these other lokas to shame for the amount of ananda and the pleasure, the well-being that can be experienced in this highest of high lokas. And then it says, but the ananda of the jnani puts all of these to shame. Mm-hmm. Upanishad, right? That's the second part of the Vedas. That's the second part of the Vedas, which releases you from the samsara. But until a person is released, until a person becomes a mumukshu, the pursuit is, how can I gain the most stable pleasure? How can I gain enough control over the world in order to be able to hang on to my well-being? To be able to afford the pleasures and then have the power to hang on to the pleasures, right? It's not enough just to get the pleasures. You have to have the power to be able to maintain the pleasures. So pleasure and power, these things, power means control. So control over my environment. So the first part of the Vedas has to do with the proper ways to gain the most pleasure and power in the environment. And by power, if you really understand what they mean, it's stability, control over the fluctuations of sukha and dukkha. So how to get that? How to be able to gain that type of control over the fluctuations of sukha and dukkha, pleasure and pain, when that pleasure and pain is being generated by the world, by my raga and dvesha. Raga, dvesha, you know, the raga, dvesha. Raga means I want this so that I can be happy. It's my passion, positive passion. Let me have this so that I can be happy. Dvesha is let me get rid of this so that I can be happy. So, raga are my likes. Dveshas are my dislikes. So all of the karmas that I do are based on raga, dvesha. I go after what I want. Why do I want it? Not so it'll make me miserable, right? I go after what I want because I believe that what I want will make me happy. And I go away from what I don't want because I believe that if I were to get that, I would be unhappy. And so therefore getting away from it, escaping it, will make me happy. Everything is about my happiness. That's what it is. And so here the Vedas, the first part of the Vedas, make all kinds of very flowery promises, you know, about all of the different lokas, all of the different worlds I can achieve, the different sthanas, the power stations that I can achieve, the pleasures that I can enjoy. In fact, if you remember in the Katha Upanishad, Yama offered Nachiketas everything imaginable. You could have all of these beautiful women and musical instruments and long life and riches and overlordship. He spent the whole first chapter. Yama spent the whole first chapter offering, trying to tempt Nachiketa's, why don't you, but what about this? What about this? And Nachiketa's kept saying, no, no, I see all of those things that just burn my senses dry. You know, if I'm immortal, I'm going to be dying anyway. What's the use of these momentary pleasures? But yeah, but what about this? I could send you up to Swargaloka. Then you have a really long life. And there are no more beautiful women than there are up there. He goes on and on and on trying to tempt. The same thing that Krishna is talking about here. In the Vedas, there's so many things. The world is offered to you. The world of pleasure and power. And when we say pleasure and power, I think of our government. But that's not. But we're talking much broader. We're talking much broader than that. Everybody seeks pleasure, and everybody seeks security to be able to control that happiness. So let me use more gentler words. Everyone seeks happiness, and everybody seeks the power to control being able to maintain that happiness. Right? That's what all beings do that. Right? And so the Vedas, the first part of the Vedas, accepting your ignorance, accepting the samsari, accepting the lack of mumukshutvam, right? You haven't seen through the problem yet. It tells you how to do this in the most benign way, in the safest way possible. Ways that will work, you know. How to fulfill your desires dharmically, and how to understand how to do that. That's the first portion of the Vedas. But that first portion of the Vedas is still within this trigunya, the three gunas. Right? It's still within the world of change. And so no matter how hard you try, the sukhas and the dukkhas that you experience are time-bound. There is no escape from that. And since there's no escape from it, that world is bound by pain. Just think about it now. If you gain a sukha, a pleasure, and that pleasure is going to be lost, what does that mean? The loss of pleasure, the loss of your... Let me put it this way. If you gain happiness, sukha, and that happiness is taken away, is lost, what is that? Dukkha. Right? Now, if the happiness that you've gained cannot stay, what is the nature really of this creation? So Swamiji says, you know, how does he say it? Sukha sukha dukkha, sukha sukha dukkha, sukha sukha dukkha. It's a or sukha dukkha. Sukha dukkha, sukha dukkha. What about when you realize the reality of that? That's when you become a mumukshu, when you realize that there's nothing you can do about that. As long as you think there's something you can do, that you can alter that, you can alter it, you have a solution, then you're still a samsari. There's still things for you to do, because you have a way out of this mess. In fact, you haven't even realized that it's a mess. You haven't realized, right? So you still think you can solve this problem. But it's when you realize you can't solve this problem, then, you know, you're a mumukshu. Then you're ready for this teaching. And so now, after Krishna has given so much teaching, the Sankhya Yoga, he's given so much teaching to Arjuna, he's now trying to prepare him for how to be in this world, right? How to be in this world in such a way that your mind can mature, that your mind can grow, can gain antakarana shuddhi, can gain that purity of mind, or can gain the vairagya necessary, right? What is the attitude with which to face this world so that my mind can mature in my knowledge? Karma Yoga, remember, Krishna has already given Arjuna knowledge. He's going to give knowledge for the rest of the Gita also. But he's given Arjuna knowledge. Now, having given him knowledge, this vision, he's giving him Karma Yoga, right? Because the mind has to mature in the light of this vision. So whether it's karma yoga, you live a karma yoga lifestyle, or a sannyasa lifestyle, either way, either lifestyle is only for the one, the mumukshu, the one who's the student, the one who's gaining this vision, who wants to gain nishta, let's put it that way, who wants a mind that actually abides in this vision, that holds this vision. So whether you live a life of sannyasa or a life of karma yoga, both are talking about the jnani, the one who's gaining knowledge, right? Or the adhikari, the one who's gaining knowledge. If that's not understood, karma yoga doesn't make any sense, right? So when does karma yoga become a path of its own? So some people think that, you know, karma yoga, there's jnana yoga, bhakti yoga, and karma yoga. All three different paths, all leading to the same goal. But this is a misunderstanding of the Gita. And it's a serious misunderstanding. Because if you think, okay, karma yoga, what do we think about that? Karma yoga, that's its own path. That means if I do karma with a proper attitude, right, when I learn a proper attitude and I do karma with a proper attitude, what is that going to result in? An experience. Right? It's all experience oriented. If I do karma with a proper attitude, my mind will have an experience. Because karma with a proper attitude is not going to give me knowledge any more than karma with an improper attitude is going to give me knowledge. What gives me knowledge is a means of knowledge. Right? So karma yoga, so what would karma yoga have in common? Karma yoga with bhakti yoga? Well, bhakti yoga is another way to give me an experience. If I practice devotion, you know, say I love to do, some people think about this as bhakti yoga. This is not bhakti yoga, but I'll tell you anyway. Bhakti yoga. I like to do puja. I'm the type of person that loves to do puja and sing bhajans. You know, I'm a bhakta. So that's what bhakti yoga is to me. I like to sing bhajans and I like to do pujas. Where you like to do karma, to go out and do good deeds for people and to do things, with, you know, to serve others. So you're a karma yogi. And that's your path. My path is bhakti. I'm a bhakta. And that's what I like to do. I like to, you know, to sing bhajans and do pujas. And then there's some of those others people, the jnana yogis, you know. Those people, they're in their heads. They're the intellectuals.
They read a lot.
They read a lot. They like to read. They like to study. You know, and that there is a path for them too. There's a path for them too. So we have these. Jnana yoga, bhakti yoga, and karma yoga. You know, that's the understanding. Three paths will all lead to the same experience. Right? This is the understanding. And now this understanding will be slowly debunked. Because this is not the vision of the Gita. The vision of the Gita and the vision is the same as the vision of the Upanishads. It's the vision is this. The self that you are is already free. Right? The Atma, the being that you are, is already whole, is already complete. It's the very self of this entire creation. No amount of bhakti, bhakti yoga, or karma, or knowledge is going to change that. It's already that way. That's already that way. No amount of karma is going to give you that. No amount of devotion is going to give you that. No amount of jnanam is going to give you that. You already are that. And so the experience that you're seeking is already completely here. It is completely here. There's nowhere to go for it. There's nowhere to gain it. There's no thing to be done. There's no thing to be done. So this is not the problem. It's not about the attainment of an experience. So then you might say, yeah, but my mind creates hell for me. That's right. Your mind creates hell for you. Why? And then we have to look at that. And how does karma yoga and bhakti yoga and jnana yoga, what is the impact that these three things have on the mind? Okay? Well, first of all, karma yoga, without knowledge, right, becomes basically just the practice of dharma. Right? Karma yoga, without knowledge, is not karma yoga. Karma yoga, without knowledge, we would say dharma. And dharma, the Vedas give. How to be in the world in such a way that you can have relative shanti. That's basically dharma and performing your duties, right? And so you can get that even in the first part of the Vedas if you start to pull away a little bit from your seeking for power and your seeking for pleasure because you've realized that dharma, this is a samsari now, the samsari realizes that the following of dharma, of doing my duties, gives me more pleasure than power and pleasure based upon sense pursuit. A person can recognize that. The following of dharma itself gives me more pleasure than seeking kamas, seeking, you know. And then I would also know from the Vedas that by my following of dharma, I gain just a certain equipoise of mind, and that will take me to heavenly worlds. Because that's a higher level of understanding. I become more sattvic. There's no knowledge involved here yet. No knowledge. But I become more sattvic. Right? Because my mind is not out pursuing one object after another in order to become happy. I'm much more engaged in understanding of dharma because of the level of shanti it gives. Still experience. I'm still working to maintain my mind, to maintain my peace of mind. If you fall out of that because you really want this one thing, right? You've practiced dharma, but you're ignorant. You still don't have self-knowledge. And some shining, glittery thing comes along, right? That you really, really want, right? And so-and-so wants it too. It's hard. It's hard. It's very, very challenging. It's very challenging because you can't, you're lying to yourself if you say, you know, I'm happy being unhappy. If I see my happiness out there, if I see my happiness out there, because I don't know where happiness is, so the world's going to be glittering here and there and everywhere, then to say that I don't need that, it's like saying, I don't need myself. Right? Because what's actually happening is your being is being projected on that. And so that's it becomes very serious. You know, because you can't be without yourself. If you be without yourself, you feel like there's a hole inside. You feel totally empty. And so these pursuits become very, very strong. Right? And sometimes it's hard to follow dharma when the pursuits are so strong. That's why even Arjuna says in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, why do I go after things, you know, that aren't good for me? You know, I go after things that aren't good for me, and then I don't do things that are good for me. St. Paul in the Bible says this. It comes up in the Mahabharata and different places. This comes up. Why do I follow after things? Why do I keep pursuing things that I know aren't good for me and not doing the things that I know are good for me? What's going on? It's so stupid. Why do we do that? We all do it. Why do I eat food that is terrible for me? I know it perfectly well. I know that I'm going to even feel sick. Why did I eat that big chocolate bar and feel sick? You know, it's interesting. When you really slow down and start seeing what the situation is. So now, Krishna has taught all of this to given this vision. He's given the vision to Arjuna. And now he wants to make him understand the place of the Vedas. That's what he's been doing. Make him understand the place of the Vedas and introduce karma yoga to him, and jnana yoga, and bhakti yoga. He uses all of these terms, but he makes you understand what it is. Karma yoga really is, in a sense, it is just your knowledge in action. Remember, he's given this knowledge to Arjuna. And so now, without that knowledge, without that understanding of who I am and what this world is, the karma yoga doesn't make any sense. Right? It's the attitude that one, the attitude of karma yoga, and again, we haven't gotten to it yet. He's going to really unfold this in the next few verses, two verses from now. But just to set you up for it, the attitude of karma yoga for the karma yogi is what is natural to a jnani. What is absolutely not is absolutely the just a natural expression of knowledge for somebody who has knowledge. And so what is natural for a jnani attitudinally becomes the sadhana, right? Becomes a sadhana, a practice, an understanding, right, for the mumukshu. But the sannyasi, means the sannyasi or the one who has jnana nishtha, is the greatest karma yogi. Right? Because all of the attitudes that the karma yogi has are absolutely the natural results of knowledge. Let me explain something else here. When we talk about the sadhana chatushtya, means the fourfold qualifications of a mumukshu, those qualifications are natural for the jnani. For instance, if you say viveka for a mumukshu, the mumukshu must have viveka. What that means is that for the mumukshu recognizes everything in my experience is anitya. Everything is time-bound. What the mumukshu doesn't know is what is nitya, what is free from time. So that half doesn't know that, because it doesn't have knowledge yet. But this, everything is time-bound, they do know. Right? That's the viveka. But now, for the jnani, what does the jnani know? I am timeless, everything in the maya is time-bound. That viveka has culminated. It culminates in knowledge. See that? The viveka itself culminates in the reality. Yes, all of this is time-bound, I'm timeless. That's viveka. That's jnanam. Vairagya. What is vairagya? For the mumukshu, the vairagya, dispassion, is that I have recognized that because everything is time-bound, these things are incapable of giving any lasting happiness. I can't become whole or complete in any lasting way from this creation. It is impossible. That's the mumukshus. Recognize that clearly. Jnani. Yes, everything in the creation is time-bound, viveka, and so therefore it is incapable of giving me anything lasting, any lasting well-being. It's absolutely impossible. But fortunately, I don't need it to because I am. Right? I am the one who is nitya. I am the ananda. Right? That's the culmination of vairagya. The culmination of vairagya is, for the mumukshu, it's kind of a hell. Like, oh my God. Nothing is going to work. Nothing here works. None of these things. So you gain a dispassion. These things can't give me what I want. You know, it's the same vairagya on an absolute level of if somebody, you know, offers you something that you have no desire for at all. Or just in the world, somebody says, here, would you like to have this? Here, wouldn't you like this? You say, no. I have no desire for it at all. You have vairagya toward that thing. You know? Because why do you have no desire? Well, I don't have any desire. I don't have any connection with it. I don't see how it can make me happy. I don't want it. I just don't. I don't want it. Because it's not going to give me what I want. How many millions of things? I mean, most of the things in the universe are like that for you. There you have your own collection of things that you really do want. But for the most part, the things that you have no desire for whatsoever, you have no attachment to them, they won't make you happy. You have no such projection on them. Okay? Now what about when the whole world is like that? These things, none of them, have the capacity of giving me what I want. And so I have this blanket vairagya, in a sense. I can gain relative pleasures from them, but I'm not looking for relative pleasure at the moment. I need to solve this fundamental problem. That is vairagya for the mumukshu. But for the jnani, that fundamental problem is solved. So the vairagya resolves in the I don't need anything. It resolves in the alam buddhi. Right? Alam buddhi means that state of everything being alam, enough. Like if the example would be like if somebody's fed you a really big meal and then they try to give you more. No, it's not, that's fine. It's fine, you know. Or if you've slept all you can sleep. Yeah. Now finally, I can't sleep anymore. I've slept enough. I have to get up. Okay, I have to get up now. Okay. That alam buddhi is there, you know. So when the vairagya for the mumukshu, there's some suffering there. But for the jnani, that vairagya resolves into no. I don't need this or this because I'm whole. I have what I need. See the difference? For the mumukshu, it's these things won't give me what I need. For the jnani, it's I have what I need. I am what I need. That wholeness, right? So again, what I'm trying to show you here is that what is sadhana for the mumukshu, and in terms of the sadhana chatushtaya, you know, that is the reality for the jnani. Now look at the others. The mumukshutvam, the desire for liberation. The jnani is liberated, you know. The mumukshu feels totally bound because viveka, vairagya, and no knowledge. So, of course, the mumukshutvam is natural. But for the jnani is liberated. So the mumukshutvam, the desire for liberation, fulfills itself. What about, you see that? It fulfills itself in the fact of it. What about Shamadhi Shatka, the group of six. Shama means the shama, the thoughts that are going through my mind. Do I have control over them? Or do they control me? You know, can I let go of a thought? Or is it like an octopus? You know, I mean, thoughts are, you have millions of thoughts are going through, no problem. They're scenery. For most of your thoughts, they're just simply scenery. You know, and you can take it or leave it. You can grab onto a thought and think about it, play with it for a while, and then let it move on. But then there's the octopus thoughts. You know, the emotional thoughts that will just grab you, right? So shama is the ability which is learned, you know, to be able to objectify that thought. And to work with it and to let it go. You have that capacity. That's the Atmavan in this verse. The Atmavan is these things that I'm talking about right now. The one who has control. Dhamma. Dhamma means if your mind is really bothering you, the octopus has come and strangling you. You're able to deal with it without acting out, without hurting others. Right? Without hurting yourself or others, without physically acting out. Upariti. So for jnani, see, the thing is, the jnani doesn't have a real need for shama, in a sense, because why, for the one who has nishta, what is the mind going to be upset about? What is the distance between, really, what is the distance between the wholeness that the mind seeks in the mind? For the jnani. What is the distance between the ananda, the source of the ananda, and the mind? It's like asking the pot, what is the distance between you and the clay? Is there anything between you? And what can get between you? You ask the pot, what can get between you and the clay? You know? Well, when you've realized that the mind has realized there is no possibility of anything intervening between me and the Atma and myself. It's not possible. And my being, it is my being that is the source of any ananda that is there in the mind, reflected in the mind, right? That type of ananda. It only comes from the Atma. And the Atma itself is its own Ananda. Right? It's what we call Swarupa Ananda. And so what can possibly... What can hurt me? Right? What hurts me, what can hurt me is when I need you to be a certain way so that I can be happy. Or I need this situation to be a certain way so that I can be happy. Or I need the world to be like this so that I can be happy. Or I need the governments to be like this so that I can be happy. I need. I might, you know, be an activist in one way or another, but not so that I can be happy, but just because that's my duty in the situation. I might take pleasure in it, but I'm not at stake. And so the Shama and the Dhamma are not things that are going to be bothering that you need. They're not something that you need. They're something that you have. See the difference? For the Jnani. For the Mumukshu, the Shama and Dhamma are values. You know, the values, so that when your mind is acting up or acting in a certain way, you learn how to handle your mind. You learn how to work with your mind to give it what it needs, so that to give it a proper environment so that it can mature. But for the Jnani, the Shama and Dhamma are natural. Upadati is for the Mumukshu. Upadati means that I'm a Mumukshu and I'm going to stay a Mumukshu until I have knowledge. I'm not a part-time Mumukshu. You know? Like, I'm a Mumukshu and I'm this and I'm this and I'm that, you know? Or they all have equal weight. That's not Mumukshu-twam. Upadati means that you've recognized the problem and because of that, your mind sticks to it, right? And on a simpler level, you can say a certain type of personality is kind of a gadfly. You know, you're interested in this for a while, mm-hmm. Then you're interested in this, then you're interested in this, and you're hopping around. You can't stick with anything. It's kind of a gadfly type personality, as opposed to somebody who is interested in a subject and will pursue the subject to mastery. That would be upadati just in the world, right? Upadati in terms of lifestyle is often called sannyasa, the person who takes sannyasa. But it need not be sannyasa. It means that you are clear about what you want. And that's primary for you. It's not that we don't work or do other things. But what the other things are not primary, right? In fact, everything in your life becomes a sadhana for this. It's not that we all do many, 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 many things. It doesn't have to live. Everybody, even sannyasis, they do many, many things. But for a mumukshu, what you are doing, everything that you're doing is circling around jnanam, gaining knowledge, gaining liberation. That's upadati. So shama dhamma upadati titiksha. So that upadati, look at for a jnani. Upadati resolves in myself, really. Like for a jnani, upadati is meaningless. Because I've already accomplished. I already know who I am. And there is no wavering from that. I'm everything. I'm the whole. Yeah? And myself is stable. Right? So, I am the stable self that is the self of the whole. So, where am I going to go where am I going to stray off to? See what I mean? For the one who is the whole, I can say, I am the whole. And that I am the stable, I am the whole, I'm the stable being of the whole. So, I say both, I'm the stable being and the stable being of the whole, I am the whole. Now, where is the one who is the whole going to stray off to? You see what I mean? If my mind goes over here, have I strayed? Not if I know I'm the whole. There's no place for me to go. So that's the upadati. Titiksha is to be able to withstand the opposites. And mumukshu has that titiksha because my primary concern is not with an object out here. My primary concern is with self-knowledge, gaining my knowledge. For the jnani, the tiksha is a given because I'm beyond the opposites. I'm not subject to the opposites. So that's the titiksha. For the agnani, for the mumukshu, the opposites are what they are. They're not what I'm seeking. See the difference? The opposites are there, but they're not what I'm seeking. So that's not where my commitment is. And so therefore I have the titiksha, the ability to handle the opposites. For the jnani, I'm always the same. The opposites aren't going to be something that disturb me. How can they disturb me? Even if they disturb my mind, I'm not disturbed. That's for the person who, if you know yourself, right? It doesn't make any difference whether the opposites are cranking up some heat, or if your mind is responding to the opposites, it doesn't make any difference because you're there. And you are always the same. This is one of the key things is the mind, once the mind recognizes, rather than taking totally for granted your own being, which is what it is for most, for an Ajnani, you totally take for granted your own being. There's no separation. And from the standpoint of the mind, of an Ajnani, there is no separation between your being and your mind. And the only focus, you are always there. You're always there exactly the same. There's never any wavering. It doesn't matter if you're a jnani or agnani. Your being is totally, fully present. But the mind's interest is only on the objects in the world, the achievements in the world, the attainments in the world, my esteem in the world, my this and my that, and my this and my that. That's where the mind is engaged, right? And it's running around trying to make everything work for me, the one who is perfectly fine. That's the miracle of it. It's running around trying to make everything fine for the one who is perfectly fine, the one who is the constant, who is the me that is always, always present. And so now, all that has to happen is that the mind, once it becomes a mumukshu and is available, has to recognize, whoa, the self that I am, the me, is never wavering at all. The very self that I am is always exactly the same. It is always whole. It is always complete. And I, the self, I become the base, the home base for the mind. I become the one that the mind rests in, that the mind is in relationship to. And it seems maybe odd when you think of the pot coming into relationship with the clay. You know? But in a sense, that's what happens. The mind comes into relationship with its own being. Right? Because there's a difference, this is the difference. Before, because the mind is always changing, thought after thought after thought after thought after thought, it has not noticed the stability of your own being that is present as the very stuff of those thoughts, the changeless stuff of those thoughts. It hasn't recognized that. And so all it's recognizing is change, 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 change. And so now what has to happen is that mind has to recognize that the change, 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 change is taking place and has for its essence the stable, changeless me. That's the recognition. Until that recognition takes place, the mind goes on changing, and that's all that is noticed. And so since myself is the very being of the changes, right? It doesn't recognize that changeless one, right, is not itself. Do you understand what I mean? There's no distance. There's nothing. There's nothing new, but there's everything new. There's nothing new at all in this recognition, except that the mind recognizes that the me is not changing as it changes. Before that, it recognized it took the me for granted. as being one with what changes. Now it recognizes, oh, wait, I don't change. As soon as it recognizes that, then the mind has a home. It has a little nest. It's in the kata. It has a little nest where it can, a little home where it can be. Right? A little safe home, a little safe harbor. Right? And that safe harbor, and it is an absolutely safe harbor. That safe harbor is the very source of ananda. It's the good mother, really. It's that which holds, that which contains, that which cannot be, is not flappable. Right? And it's where that's the source of love. There is no love out here. There's no, if you may love someone. You think you do. You do. But honestly, I mean, you do, because we have relationships. But what I'm saying is that when I say you think you do, kind of facetiously, it's because that the love that you experience, the feeling of love, the feeling of warmth, that can, of course, turn to hate on a dime. Right? But the feeling of love, the feeling of warmth, what is that? It's your mind relaxing. That's all it is. And your being reflecting in that relaxed mind gives you that sensation of love or well-being. That's what it is, you know. And one, for jnani, like the one who understands that, does not require an external person or situation or world. Doesn't require anything for that love. That doesn't mean that all of a sudden the jnani says, well, I found the love, and so, you know, none of you are needed. Shoo, 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 shoo. It has nothing to do with that. It means that I can love you. I can just love. You don't have to be a particular way. That's what it means. I can be in relationship with you, and you don't have to be a particular way, because my well-being is not dependent on you or how you are. That's why being with somebody like Swamiji or somebody who's very mature, you know, and they're nishta, you feel very safe. Feel safe because their well-being, you're not going to hurt their well-being, you know. So they can accept you as you are. And you feel that, you know. You feel that they're not, you know, flappable. Or you go and discover they're not flappable. It's because the self is not flappable. You also are not flappable. It's the only problem is that the mind needs to discover that. The mind needs to discover that and come into relationship with that. Right? And so all of these things, Ishamadamu Paratititiksha, Shraddha is that quality that allows you to listen to this teaching. Where there's something, for some reason, your mind says, I think this teaching has something, I want to listen. And so there's an openness. And to the teacher, it has the same thing. Okay, she seems to know what she's talking about. That's fine, I can listen to her or him. That's Shraddha. It's a faith pending understanding. For some, it's considered Ishvara Anugraha. It's a great grace. What about for the jnani? What is the Shraddha? Resolves into knowledge. It's not faith for the jnani. Shraddha resolves into knowledge. You have, Shraddha means you start with, for the mumuksha, you have some sense. There's something here. I want to know. Jnani, you know it. Right? Samadhanam, the absorption into the self. For the jnani, you're never not absorbed in yourself. That's not even a possibility. So, what I'm saying is the sadhana chatushtaya for the mumukshu is the reality for the jnani. Karma yoga for the mumukshu is the reality for the jnani. You know? So this is what is to understand what is an absolutely natural What is absolutely natural for one who has knowledge becomes a sadhana, right? What is obvious as night and day for the jnani is the sadhana, becomes a sadhana for the mumukshu. And here in this karma yoga, so let's wind this up for now. So look at what he says. That he says the Vedas themselves, the karmakanda for the samsaris, that's the three gunas. You know, I want you, hey Arjuna, to be in this trigunya. Don't set your sights on these things. These things will not give you any ananda. So don't be seeking out here. Be nirdvandvaha. You need to be somebody who's free of these opposites. Who's free of the opposites? Atma, the self. Nitya sattvastaha. Let your mind be sattva. Sattva means you're not engaged out here. It's sattva has to do with knowledge. The sattva mind, let your mind enjoy yourself. Let the attachment be to yourself. And then the mind is just sattva. You appreciate, you experience the creation. You're not asking it to be in a particular way. And so that sattva buddhi means that mind reflects yourself as you are. So there's ananda in that. So always let yourself have the sattva buddhi. Nir yoga kshema, be without yoga and kshema, means don't think. And he's going to, this whole verse is now, we're going to be spending a long time. He's going to unfold all of this. Nir yoga kshema, be without this yoga, I need this to be happy. Be without this kshema, I need to keep this to be happy. Right? You don't need yoga to kshema. Your ananda is not dependent upon your gains, and you don't have to maintain anything to be happy. In fact, this is a huge thing. Because when you understand what it means to be without yoga kshema, it means your prarabdha takes care of everything. Right? Because otherwise, how can you say, what do you mean? I have to control. I have to make sure that I get what I need. See, in the Gita, you'll see, you don't have to control anything. You just do what there's to be done. You do what's before you to be done. You know, let Ishwara can be the control. Let Ishwara be in control. And you do what needs to be done. That's what you need to do, nothing else. Don't worry about the yoga and kshema. Let Ishwara take care of that. He'll talk a lot about that. That understanding is such an incredible freedom. Because otherwise, again, inner creation, I have to decide what I have to do in order to be whole and complete, or in order just to live the next day. It's much different when you understand that this whole creation, right, is yourself. It's infinite knowledge. When you understand the whole thing is Ishwara, it is infinite knowledge of which this body, mind, sense organs is a part. It's an infinite story, and you are a part of that story. And so you also have free will in it. You can try to, you know, take over the wheel, or you can enjoy your prarabdha and do what there is to be done, because the creation takes care of you in that way. Just think about it. Just think about it. You have plenty to do at all times. We do. We have plenty to do at all times. And there's never been a moment when that's not true. It's very interesting. Think about it. Okay, let's stop there. Purnamadah, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamadachate, Purnasya Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.